content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Martha Potter from the North Carolina Reading Service. For the next half hour, I'll be reading to you from Our State Magazine. Today's reading of Our State Magazine is underwritten by Carter Glass Insurance Agency, serving the community since 1974 and underwriting this podcast for over 15 years. They can be reached at 919-781-1973. In this last episode for August, we'll wrap up the last of the articles from the August issue of Our State Magazine from the theme, which is entitled The Lunch Break, and features articles about favorite lunch spots around the state. And we hope we will be able to dip into a couple of other articles in the magazine as well. First up is an article entitled Lunchtime Legacy. In downtown Hendersonville, a sandwich shop has become a gathering place that has fed neighbors, families, and friendships for generations. In a way, it all started with the coffee and cookie hour. 8-year-old Matthew Rogers had spent the morning curating the spread before him. Cups of lemonade, cookies in varying shades of vanilla and chocolate, and empty mugs awaiting strong Episcopalian coffee. With everything finally set, just so, he didn't want anyone to touch it. Not yet. Once his father, the pastor, spoke the benediction and the congregants came pouring out, then Matthew would step back and watch the magic happen. The room would fill with laughter and overlapping conversations, and he'd know that his perfectly assembled table had helped to make that happen and had drawn people closer together. It's been more than 50 years since Rogers was a kid serving cookies at church, but chances are if you step off Main Street in Hendersonville and happen down 3rd Avenue today, you'll see him in that same position, standing back to observe his handiwork. In Three Chopped Sandwich Shop, the restaurant he bought from Jim Young back in 1990, the now 66-year-old Rogers often watches from the open kitchen as the lunch crowd leans into sandwiches he's arranged just so. For him, this is the sweet spot, seeing the spread he's laid out bring people together. I've been one of those people since I needed a booster seat, shoveling in the free popcorn while I waited on my sandwich. Over my lifetime, the most reliable fixture in Three Chopped has been Rogers, framed by the giant serving window, facing the dining room instead of the kitchen. While he makes sandwiches in his Cincinnati Reds hat and observes the crowd, watching the magic. But owning a sandwich spot in a small town isn't all satisfied watching from a distance. When he's caught up on orders, he'll appear from the kitchen to float among the tables. The Cardinals are on a skid, he might tell my dad, a St. Louis fan. They'll talk baseball before Rogers moves on to hand bowls of fruit to kids or ponder the state of SEC football with a table of attorneys. Or sometimes when the mood strikes, he'll take to song right there in the middle of the room, belting out so that everyone turns to listen, as if they're family at one big table and not strangers scattered among many. In 1996, when Three Chopped moved into its current home on 3rd Avenue, a contractor friend from church offered to help Rogers transform the former flower shop into a restaurant. But the budget was tight. I have enough money, I think, for plumbers and electricians, Rogers told him, but I don't think I can pay you. Unfazed, the contractor showed Rogers how to lay the floor and build the shelves. You're going to help the community here, he explained. I can do this for you. Rogers compensated him the best way he knew, with free lunch, that and living up to the contractor's prediction. Singing or not, lunchtime is a community event at Three Chopped. Retirees join suited men and women from nearby law offices and families with small kids visiting hands-on children's museum around the corner. When they sit, guests are handed bowls of popcorn and menus full of names: Radiant Rosie, Sweet Sue, Lovable Larry, Bountiful Barrett. Most of the sandwiches are named for family. My go-to, Elizabeth's Mile Marker, turkey, bacon, Swiss, lettuce, tomato, and house-made honey mustard on sourdough, is named after Roger's sister, a teacher. Radiant Rosie is Roger's wife and co-owner of the restaurant. Grilled chicken, provolone, lettuce, tomato, and house-made ranch. Dearest David is his father. Roast beef and turkey, Swiss, lettuce, tomato, and Thousand Island. And Apple Raisin Annie, the bestseller, his mother. Chicken salad, golden raisin, Granny Smith apples, lettuce, tomato, and honey mustard. The sandwiches, like the coffee and cookies, are a means to an end, a way to take part in a place but also to shape it for the better. Give them their money's worth, Roger's grandfather always advised, and then give them something a little extra. For Rogers, the whole endeavor is about community. Dozens of high schoolers have slung sandwiches here on their way to somewhere else. Oh, she's a surgeon now, he says, pointing to a Polaroid of a teenage waitress on the wall. He hosts pancake best breakfast fundraisers for big brothers and big sisters and spaghetti dinners for the Boys and Girls Clubs. He's watched kids, like me, eat handfuls of popcorn until one day they're adults, scooting their own kids up to the table to order, making their own banter about the state of the National League Central. An homage to family, a shrine to where it all began, resides in the corner of the restaurant. His grandmother's needlepoint, "The gift is small, but love is all," hangs on the wall alongside family heirlooms and old photographs. Pictured there are Roger's paternal grandparents who came by train with other Swedes to settle in Tryon more than a century ago. Dearest David stands upright in his army uniform. Apple Raisin Annie, who helped him get started in the restaurant business after college and who served in the Peace Corps at age 65, smiles there too. A side effect of feeding people for nearly 40 years is that now every inch of the walls is covered by something. Cincinnati Reds baseball memorabilia, pictures of waterfalls, notes from Boys and Girls Clubs kids, framed quotes, and of course photos of former employees and longtime diners, because the family corner is always growing. After all, Super Sam, a wrap of turkey, Swiss, cucumber, banana peppers, and Italian dressing, wasn't a blood relation, but a firefighter who could fix anything. Marvelous Marvin, turkey, roast beef, Swiss, cheddar, banana peppers, onion, coleslaw and horseradish, Thousand Island and Dijon mustard, wasn't kin, but he was a champion for the Special Olympics, helping out and hanging around are ingredients enough to wind up in the family and on the menu. When a blizzard brought Hendersonville to a standstill in 1993, Rogers stayed at Three Chopped. He knew his house in the big hungry community would be cut off from the world when the snow fell, so he bunked in the finished space below the restaurant and woke to a world covered in white. The only movement on Main Street that morning were crews trying to clear the roads and sidewalks, so with his restaurant open and everything else closed, Rogers trudged up the hill midday. "Hey, I've got soup and chili and some hot tea. Just come down. It's on the house." Before long, his tables were filling with city and DOT workers looking for a little shelter from the cold. He kept the bowls of chili flowing as everyone thawed out. And then, of course, the lawyers showed up, Rogers remembers. As the room filled with laughter and warmth, he stepped back for a beat to watch from his usual spot in the kitchen. He liked what he saw spread before him: orange vests, suits and ties, and steaming soup. People coming in together because of a carefully arranged table. That, he says, picturing the scene three decades earlier, is the joy of community. And the Three Chopped Sandwich Shop is on 3rd Avenue East in Hendersonville, North Carolina. And you can find out more about them if you go to ourstate.com/3-chopped. ourstate.com/3-chopped. And that's spelled C-H-O-P like Peter, T like Tom. And our last lunchtime-themed article is entitled Cafeteria Classics. During one collector's elementary years, it didn't matter what his parents packed inside his lunchbox. Back in the day, the real prize was on the outside. Asheville Pinball Museum owner T.C. DeBella knows firsthand the durability of a good lunchbox. His own childhood lunchbox, a star-spangled tribute to legendary stuntman Evel Knievel, bears only a few cosmetic scuffs after both he and his brother Kelly carried it throughout the 70s and 80s to Coates Elementary School in Harnett County. Just as long-lasting, DeBella says, are the memories that are keepsakes like these are memories that keepsakes like these can evoke. As he stares into Evel Knievel's roguishly charming visage, his body might be at the Asheville Pinball Museum, which he co-owns with his wife, Brandy, and technician John French. But his mind is back in the lunchroom. He's scarfing down the ham and cheese sandwich his mom made, showing his friends the daredevil motorcycle. You'd be sitting there with your lunchbox out, and everyone would look at each other's, DiBella says at the impromptu show-and-tell session. The vintage metal tins were meant to be lingered over. Each represented an art gallery in miniature, boasting on every side illustrations based on a cultural touchstone like E.T. the Extraterrestrial, Peanuts, or the Beatles. As an adult, DiBella now flaunts an assemblage that would have left his cafeteria chums slack-jawed. He owns nearly 230 lunchboxes by his reckoning, more than anyone else in North Carolina, and one of the largest private collections in the country. Museum visitors gaze upon a curated few amid the chimes and bells of the pinball machines, and he has plans to reopen a dedicated lunchbox exhibit that was shuttered by Hurricane Helene. DiBella started his acquisitions in early 2020 after a visitor from Atlanta, who happened to be a Knievel fan himself, saw his old lunchbox on display at the museum. The man was downsizing for a cross-country move. Seeking to offload some of his own lunchbox collection, he invited DiBella to visit his house and take a look. Presented with a wall of more than 100 well-preserved artifacts, the Asheville-ian felt compelled to give them a good home. I asked, "Well, how much?" He replied, "Which one?" I said, "The whole thing." DiBella says with a chuckle, he forked over $5,000, carefully located all the boxes into a Dodge Grand Caravan, and took them back to Asheville, intending to showcase them around his pinball machines. The pandemic paused that plan, but pushed DiBella to expand his new lunchbox library. He scoured the internet and local thrift shops for overlooked gems, and as word spread, friends started bringing him their school lunchboxes as well. He insisted every edition feature something that he liked, admittedly a fairly easy bar to clear for the pop culture devotee, whose office decor runs the gamut from Chuck Norris to Invader Zim. By 2022, DiBella had established the Lunchbox Hall of Fame in a cozy space beneath the museum. Drawing on his former career as a middle school teacher, he created an educational signage explaining every lunchbox's cultural import and value. The Munsters is one of his rarest, worth more than $700. More than 11,000 visitors paid the $1 admission before he had to close the exhibit due to water damage. Despite Helene's wrath, DiBella's durable lunchboxes emerged unscathed, ready to inspire more memories. He hopes to set up the whole collection at another space in downtown Asheville. When people see their old lunchbox, they start taking pictures of it. That is such a neat feeling, DiBella says. Like when he was a kid, he loves to watch others get excited about what he's brought to show off. The Asheville Pinball Museum is located at One Battle Square in Asheville, North Carolina, and their website is ashevillepinball.com. And I'm going to describe to you a couple of the ones that he has that are pictured here, the lunchboxes. There's a Superman lunchbox, and these are all like from comic book era Superman in the 60s and such. And then there's a Beatles-inspired lunchbox with the Fab Four on the lid, on the top. Then there's the Bionic Woman, and it shows her at front of a classroom, and she's ripping the telephone book in half with her bare hands, and then shows her a close-up inset of her. Then there's Evel Knievel, an inset of his portrait, and then his name, and then him jumping over a line of cars. Of T.C. DiBella's nearly 230 lunchboxes, including ones promoting the Beatles and Superman from 1966 and the Bionic Woman from 1976, the Evel Knievel lunchbox is the only one that held his lunchbox, his actual school lunch. If I turn the page, we have one, we have an E.T., which shows Elliot touching the fingertip of E.T., and E.T. the Extraterrestrial. And then we've got the Munsters lunchbox that he mentioned there. Well, now that we've finished all of the lunch-related articles, we'll turn to a couple of the regular categories in the magazine. This one is called Hidden History, uncovering forgotten artifacts and delving into dusty archives to explore the little-known stories of our state. This one is called Camp Dreamland. In 1944, a Jewish refugee from Berlin started a summer camp near Blowing Rock, nurturing a generation of boys in an idyllic world of nature, music, art, theater, and literature. An ancient oak stands watch in a clearing, bearing witness to an extraordinary summer camp that once thrived under its spreading canopy. Today, the wind is still, but when it blows, as it often does here up in the high country of Watauga County, it rustles the shimmering leaves, summoning ghosts of summer's past. According to Charles A. Miller, a former camper who wrote a historical narrative called A Catawba Assembly, the first time Vera Lachman set eyes on the property that was to become Camp Catawba, she resolved to buy it. She had arrived in America less than 5 years earlier, one of the last Jews to escape Nazi Germany in 1939. She came with little more than a doctorate degree from the University of Berlin and a dream of creating a summer camp for boys. After temporary teaching jobs at Vassar College, Yale University, and Salem College, the poet and professor settled in New York to teach, leaving her summers free to turn her dream into a reality. A short hike from the Moses Cone Manor in Blowing Rock, the 20-acre property had once been a summer camp for girls, featuring a main house with a kitchen, a larger bunkhouse that was renamed the Citadel, and an arts and crafts cabin. From the beginning, Camp Catawba was a kind of grand improvisation, short on resources, infrastructure, and organization, but overflowing with Lachman's passions and creativity. Most of the campers came from New York, Philadelphia, and Washington, D.C., and Lachman sought to nurture their appreciation for nature. There was an abundance of typical summer camp activities, archery, badminton, baseball, swimming, hiking, and horseback riding. But alongside these familiar pursuits, campers played the music of Bach, Handel, and Mozart, rehearsed the plays of Shakespeare, Molière, and Aristophanes, and took painting classes from artists whose works hung in prestigious galleries. Alumnus Robert Jergrau remembers performing in August Strindberg's A Dream Play during his second summer. Lachman was passionate about bringing young people along, she says. She could really go wild in terms of what to expose the kids to. We were never given the, quote, child version. In 1945, Lachman met the composer and recorder virtuoso Tui St. George Tucker, and in 1946, invited her to become the music director at Camp Catawba. Dr. Reeves Schulstad, a professor at the Hayes School of Music at Appalachian State University, had studied the two women, who also became life partners. Vera was a peacemaker, and Tui liked to stir things up, Schulstad says. Rarely did a choir practice conducted by Tucker conclude without one or several campers being dismissed for any one of a number of musical indiscretions, but her tirades were like the thunderstorms that rarely blew into camp, brief, intense, and quickly forgotten. The two women with contrasting personalities were adored by the campers. Both Vera and Tui were marvelous with young people, Jergrau recalls. To this day, he cherishes the way the women related to him, just to be treated like a real person, not just as a kid. Every week, Lachman wrote a letter to the parents of the campers, providing a glimpse into the special world she and her staff created. She recounted dramatic hikes, frustrations with rainy weather, and vivid descriptions of what free time at camp looked like. Yet what is most striking are her frequent and detailed mentions of the music that was constantly made throughout the campus, including at Sunday services, around campfires, and in special concerts. The choir sang Gregorian chants, choruses from works by Mendelssohn and Mozart, spirituals, folk tunes, and robust versions of Happy Birthday when the occasion required. Even the cancellation of outdoor activities due to rain was announced with a musical joke. Handel's water music played from the speakers in the Citadel. Each day end was marked by the cry, "Story on the Hill!" Campers scurried up to the Citadel and into their pajamas. Upon Lachman's arrival, the boys gathered round and she presented her version of a bedtime story, either the Iliad or the Odyssey. In her telling, the epic poems were as enthralling as any Hardy Boys mystery. Lachman concluded each evening's installment with a cliffhanger and then the words, "And that is all I'm going to tell you tonight." By the end of an 8-week session, the boys had a grounding in Greek literature to rival any college freshman. Everyone agrees that Lachman was what made the place special. In many ways, she and her campers would have been considered the ultimate outsiders in rural Appalachia during the 1940s, 50s, and 60s, but her personality, her warmth, kindness, and wisdom melted any friction. When the camp integrated in 1964, it was without incident. David Bull attended Camp Catawba for 4 years and later went on to have a career as a producer for the Oprah Winfrey Show. He saw how Lachman interacted with everyone she met. "She was beloved," he says. "She bought locally. She paid her bills on time. There was a lot of goodwill, even though she was not local." Camp Catawba's closest neighbors, a farming couple named Ira and Sally Bullock, became like extended family to the boys. Ira was the ultimate good neighbor, cutting the grass using a team of horses and a mower, dispensing advice, offering up the Bullock's front porch to one and all, and giving at least one curious camper a plug of tobacco. The art program received a boost when Bull's father, Jack, decided to accompany his son to make sure Camp Catawba met with his approval. The Brooklyn-born artist, whose work is featured in the permanent collections of the National Galleries of Art and the National Museum of American History, fell in love with the place. The feeling was mutual. Lachman implored him to come back, and he did just that, returning again and again as a volunteer art instructor. Lachman attracted plenty of luminaries, and the camp's good fortune was revealed in other ways, too. It skirted a host of potential calamities: the polio epidemic in the 40s and 50s, budget shortfalls. The camp lost money every year but one, and a water moccasin that took up residence at the camp's muddy-bottomed pool one summer. The climax of each 8-week sessions was a concert featuring choir and orchestra, followed by the performance of a play that the campers had rehearsed diligently since their arrival. Attended by family, friends, and local residents, it was the perfect coda to a summer of excitement and adventure. In 1970, at the age of 65, Lachman closed Camp Catawba, deciding she no longer had the energy the camp required. She and Tucker spent summers at Catawba and the remainder of the year in New York City, where several former campers became their students, including Jurgrau. Even after his formal education was complete, Jurgrau made friends with his two mentors, regularly cooking dinner for them in New York. He went on to become an executive for Time Warner and a consultant for the Juilliard School. But he's always happy to reminisce about the summers he spent at Camp Catawba. I hope hearing about it inspires others to bring younger people together and give them exposure to things that will make them deeper, richer people, he says. After Lachman died in 1985, Tucker remained a vibrant memorial presence at Catawba for nearly two decades. She threw parties in the main house, inviting students and faculty from nearby Appalachian State and introducing a new generation of musicians to her avant-garde recorder compositions and other orchestral works. Today, Dr. Schulstedt carries that creative flame forward. She shares the story of Tucker and Lachman's lives with her students to illustrate what it means to live a deeply thought-out creative life. She's also making Tucker's virtuosic recorder music more accessible and introducing her students to groundbreaking microtonal music. After Tucker's death in 2004, at age 79, the camp property was passed to the Blue Ridge Parkway. The buildings became ghostly ruins. In 2018, the collapsing structures were torn down and carried off. What remains are many of the same plants and trees that graced the camp back in the day. Lush stands of rhododendron, maples, a rare hemlock, a hydrangea plant as tall as a giant, and the mighty oak that the boys once sat under, dreaming about warrior heroes, Olympian gods, and glory. Our last article will be from the section entitled A Taste of Our State, Savoring North Carolina Through Flavors of Home, and this is entitled Romancing the Vine. One food writer's love affair with tomatoes was a slow burn, building summer by summer until finally she brought them home. I was a late bloomer when it came to homegrown tomato love. It wasn't from lack of exposure. It seemed that my family ate fresh tomatoes all season long when I was growing up. They stacked fat slabs of ruby red and sunny yellow tomatoes between perfectly square slices of flimsy, pillowy white bread laid thick with mayo. They plunked juicy, bite-sized chunks atop bowls of creamy cottage cheese dusted with black pepper. They rolled cherry tomatoes, which we call tummy toes, into garden salads. They swung platters of sliced tomatoes around the supper table as though heeding a square dance call. At the time, none of that tempted me. I first flirted with tomatoes at the Carborough Farmers Market in the mid-90s. I met farmers who grew tomatoes in sizes, shapes, and colors that I never knew existed. Some were as tiny as garden peas, and others too hefty to hold in one hand. Some were smooth and firm, while others were gnarly, bumpy, and beautifully ugly, prized for their flavor over their appearance. There were plenty of red ones, but also yellow, orange, purple, green, and white and solid stripes, speckles, and what looked like cross sections of sunsets. I discovered that tomatoes have fanciful names, family trees, and origin stories. More importantly, I learned they don't all taste the same, and some are delicious in ways that require all of our senses. At the time, all of that tempted me. As that fabulous Guy Clark song goes, only two things that money can't buy, and that's true love and homegrown tomatoes. He is not wrong. There are more than 10,000 tomato varieties in the world. Hundreds of different types can grow somewhere in North Carolina, but some flourish here, including heirloom varieties such as Cherokee Purple, Red Brandywine, and German Johnson. One spring, I bought seedlings of each of those, plus a Sungold, a spectacular cherry tomato that's the color of marigolds and sweet as candy. I felt affectionate toward tomatoes, but I didn't fall in love until I grew my own. Lacking a proper garden plot, I planted each one in its own large plastic bucket so that I could move them around the yard, chasing sunshine, yet not exceeding the reach of my watering hose. As the plants grew, I ruthlessly picked off suckers, yet gently tied up tender stems that links of soft, stretchy pantyhose that were vestiges of my last corporate job. I veiled them with netting and sprayed them with organic potions, hoping that the munching critters could view the seam as a mission slightly possible. I made countless trips to the garden supply store. I fed, fussed, and cooed over those four plants, and in due time, I picked my first homegrown tomato at my home. I ate it like an apple. The flesh was sun-warmed, umami-laced, sweet, tangy, slightly earthy, and herbaceous. Its juices ran down my arm and sent me scurrying to the sink to lean way over. All told and tallied, it's possible that one tomato cost me 40 hours and $50. Friends, I am bragging, not complaining. It was worth it. Come time the following year, I was tempted to do it again. That's the persuasion of a perfect North Carolina tomato, hybrid or heirloom, homegrown or via someone else is generous enough to give a paper sack of theirs on your doorstep. Or handpicked by farmers at one of our many farmers markets and produce stands. Locals' tomatoes know when to make their move to win us over. All those times, there's no resisting temptation. Well, we've run out of time for today's episode of Our State Magazine. I hope you enjoyed it and that you'll be sure to listen next time. I'm Martha Potter, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. Today's reading of Our State Magazine is underwritten by Carter Glass Insurance Agency, serving the community since 1974. They can be reached at 919-781-1973. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired, and this broadcast is readily available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. For any questions or comments, give us a call at 919-832-5138. So long for this time.